also then an option of the railgun. So we try to explain what is the railgun. Well, the military is actively using the railguns, and it was proposed to for the first time by the Star Wars. And eventually U.S. government programs decided to pay attention to it. So we're talking about a small scale of reaction. And then I'm going to give Dr. Roy a microphone and eventually support the statement with explaining the mechanism of that reaction. Dr. Roy.
C2GS, keep in mind it's 10:13, it's coming close to Paul's time, so we can't kind of do this for too much longer. Basically, that YouTube video is not science, that is a circus act. A science kind of proves it. You take this device, you put it in a colorimeter, which is able to record the amount of energy produced, and you know the amount of power that you use to generate the arc. And then you say, well, it's equal, it's less, it's more. You don't futz around with demonstrations of blowing things up, because that doesn't give you qualitative numbers. As far as PhDs getting things wrong, Fleischmann and Pons of cold fusion got their thing wrong. The guys who built the M-drive got their thing wrong. The guys who did the room temperature superconductor got those things wrong. There are thousands of articles in scientific journals, some of which are respectable, where the people who wrote it were idiots and they got it all wrong. So the fact that it got written up doesn't mean squat. And another thing, there was something in one of those articles where a pea brain decided that the extra energy was coming from solar energy that was adjusting the hydrogen bonding, which is completely ridiculous. You want to prove that? Fine. Take some water, electrolyze it to hydrogen and oxygen, so it's not water anymore. Then in darkness, recombine it so it's not been exposed to any solar energy, and use that drop on the experiment and see if it produces a decrease in the amount of energy, which you couldn't do because they have no quantitative way of measuring the energy because they blow up pieces of copper and what have you. It's a farce. It's nonsense. It was written, one of the articles, 20 years ago, and nothing has come of it. If you think that if there was something legitimate, the military jumped at people who thought that they could talk to goats. So if they thought that they could talk to goats, they would throw millions of dollars at this nonsense. And they probably have, and it probably went no place, but since the Defense Department doesn't publish a lot of the ways that they waste money, we didn't hear from it. But we got to tie this all up soon, Wesley.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. I agree with that. Fleischmann and Pound were actually wrong, and many others that you mentioned were wrong. There's no magic source of energy, no new source of energy discovered. But there was another video in Russian language. I don't know if Dr. Roy was able to understand it. It was presenting a rocket made of plastic bottle with a little water on it and also the fuse. Similar to the fuse that was presented by Dr. James, whatever. And then he decided that, the rocket was using the impulse, also the fuse, which is a piece of aluminum, he was delivering an impulse to the rocket, and when that aluminum fuse blows, it creates an arc, and the rocket starts to fly. So it was like 23 meters, we're talking 70 feet high. But then he decided that he doesn't want to use any fuse. He wants to use just salt water. No fuse at all. And all of a sudden his rocket on that video flies to 40-something meters, 49 meters. So we're talking 150 feet on the top. And of course, Dr. Roy might say this is not a scientific. There is an explanation of water bracket in the Wikipedia. I'm not going to go to it. NASA was also dreaming about and experimenting with water power engines offered that offer satellite mobility, and it started since 1960, and it's still in their agenda.
You mean like the M-Tribe was?
No, I have the articles for it. In front of me says that NASA have been experimenting for since 1960 with water-powered rockets, with hydrogen rockets. They were actually testing water electrolysis rockets, but they were not successful in the small device that would be able to, like you say, electrolyte the water to the gaseous state and then eventually use it as fuel.
Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of things on their list. They don't spend a lot of money on any of them, but fortunately they spend a lot on press releases. And so, you know, the TechNet spent way too much time discussing the M-Drive. It made no particular sense when it was announced, continued to make no particular sense, and when everyone finally figured out why it wasn't working, then thankfully we were able to retire that. But it must have been talked around the TechNet a couple of years in a row before it was completely squashed. You know, a lot of people have a lot of interesting ideas. Occasionally they're good, usually they're bad, and it usually takes time and money to prove that they're bad.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. I have a few quotes to say. So it is a water arc explosion in which an electric arc is used to trigger the violent expansion of the small amount of water. So we're talking about droplets. And prior to research suggested that firing high current poles through the liquid water releases energy stored in the water. But now they use not water, they use the droplets. And they see the fork, the kinetic energy resulting in explosion tearing the water apart into tiny fork droplets. And then the article that explains the process stands that explanation is for the fog explosion is that they are caused by liberation of intermolecular bonding energy when the bulk water is transformed into tiny fog droplets. Of course, we can discuss that and say, hey, bonding energy, what you're trying to prove, are you talking about hydrogen bonds, the van der Waals forces, the energy stored in the bonds, the latent heat of the water, what you talking about? You'd be trying to be short in it. It's not going to be that easy to understand. Is that there is an E, the small droplets have significantly fewer neighbors than in the bulk water, and they can reorient themselves more easily into the low energy state like droplets. So those lower energies imply to the bonds, and the bonds become stronger. The bond redistribution behavior is normally observed in the thin films of water called vicinal water. And the result of inelastic incoherent neutron scatterings show that the hydrogen have a two bonds. When they were experimenting in water and with water and ice, so one is strong, one is weak force, and they calculated as a 24 and 32 mega electron volts, which is not that strong. I mean, CG-137 is what, 611 kilo-electron volts. We have plenty of naturally existing active isotopes that have more than that, and they are decaying. And or do so. Those bonds are referred as the weak and strong bonds, and when you have a newly formed droplet, some of the weak bonds drop to the strong bond energy in the quantum shift. I know what they mean by that. There will be the consequent release of kinetic energy causing the vicinal droplets to repel each other, resulting in the observed explosion. So the same is true for the hydrogen bond. When the hydrogen bond is formed between the pair of molecules where they previously held together by van der Waals forces. So this is like a condensed form of explanation because we don't have much more time. But they're talking about vibrational energy, and that vibrational energy is able, I'm trying to find that, strength. Okay, never mind, back to you.
Yeah, we're going to have to call it a night, Wesley. Look, I hate the poll status. I have a degree in chemistry, and most of what you said is word salad nonsense. I know what hydrogen bonds are. I know what van der Waals forces are. None of them have to do with this situation in the slightest. You have different hydrogen bonds between different molecules. You don't have hydrogen bonding from the same molecule, changing vibrational states, yada, yada, make-believe quantum words. So as a guy with a measly bachelor's in chemistry, this is drivel, and I still, if I had the power, would pull every single one of the author's PhDs and send them to pump gas at an EV station. Anyway, thank you very much, Wesley. I do appreciate it, though, despite the fact that I don't agree with you with this. Thank you very much, but it's already 10:25, and it's way time for Paul, WS2N, and the Space Net Report.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Thank you very much for disagreeing with me. But we're talking about five universities, about 15 names on those reports who actually state different. Of course, I wasn't able to go through all of it. And when I was quoting the last comment, I said I don't know what they mean by that. So actually, I was kind of agreeing with you. But for me, it's hard to believe that Oxford University, among other universities, are wrong, and you are right. Maybe there is a miscommunication. Back to you.
Before I call on Paul once again, I will just quote Shakespeare. It is a tale, now, not really told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Look, I don't care if he came from Oxford. There are a lot of guys who get degrees all kinds of places who are imbeciles. They're imbeciles, or they're grifters, or they're con men, or there's something shady, because those paragraphs don't mean anything. It's just stuff that they made up at the end to explain why their lab values were probably wrong. So we'll leave it at that. Paul, please, save us.
Yeah. You know, in the second I heard EM drive, I said, oh, no. No, don't bring that back, Roy. And then I realized what you were saying. No more of that. Anyway, yeah, I'm not a scientist type, but a practical type. I spent a lot of time welding, and I remember welding many times on a roof, or maybe on a cooling tower with gigantic pipes, and all of a sudden it would start raining, and there would be a couple of raindrops that would hit that arc, and you know what, Roy, I never blew myself up. Anyway, this is WS2N for the Space Net Report. Okay, for the TechNet. Very good. If I go into rockets and space technology, I just want to bring up something that LIMARC is behind a contact, an ARES contract, amateur radio on the International Space Station. There's a school, Ballystream South High School, over there in Nassau County that LIMARC has gotten involved with. They're going to contact the space station on Tuesday morning at 8:25 a.m. So what happens is they have a YouTube that they published the ARRL, so, you know, they send out weekly letters, and in that the Hudson director, he prints a lot of information on the line mark. He actually has a YouTube that you can click on at that time in the morning, 8:25 a.m. on Tuesday morning, and you'd be able to hear the conversations between the students of Valley Stream High School. Well, it's south. They have two schools over there, Valley Stream South High School, and the Ares contact. And the astronaut they're supposed to contact with is going to be Morgenstein. He's the one of the people that went up on the Falcon 9 rocket a week or two ago, a couple of weeks ago. And one of the people on board was Jasmine from Long Island. So I'm thinking maybe they'll put her on as well. It's anyway, astronaut Morgenstein is KG5GCZ, but you wouldn't hear that. You'd hear just NA1SS. That would be the call letter for the space station. But this YouTube, I guess you'd be able to see them. They're probably live streaming it. I'll try that on Tuesday morning. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay, very good. Big news was last Friday morning. We had a Falcon 9. They call it a Falcon Heavy now, but it was three Falcon 9 rockets bolted together, so they call that the heavy. It's like three Falcon 9s going up in one shot. So it was 5.2 million pounds of thrust. They pushed it into the sky. The Psyche spacecraft, I've talked about that many times on its net. Psyche spacecraft is on the way to an asteroid with the same name, Psyche number 16, they call it 16, because that was the 16th asteroid that they discovered many, many years ago. So it's going to take quite a while to get there. It won't get there until 2029. But it launched on this Falcon Heavy rocket, and that's the eighth time that SpaceX has used that rocket. But it's the first time that NASA actually used it. They've launched the Falcon Heavy for the military or for foreign countries, but this is the first time NASA got involved with it. Went up fine. Actually, it was supposed to go up the day before, but on Thursday, but it went up Friday morning. Boosters came back. Boosters on the aft and on the port and the starboard side came back and landed back at landing zone 1 and 2. SpaceX took over a launch complex years ago called Launch Complex 13 that was abandoned for decades. So they took it over and they put two big concrete circles over there and they called landing zone 1 and 2. And sure enough, both boosters came back successfully and landed there, which is a good thing because NASA's going to use those same two boosters next year when they launch the Clipper, the Europa Clipper, another mission that's going to go to orbit Jupiter. And in doing that, it will come very close to Europa many, many times, I think like 40 different times over the years. And it'll get plenty of information when it's very close to it. And then when it pulls away, it'll retransmit that information back down to Earth. But this time around, it's Psyche. It's going to take 6 years to get out there. But now, it's an expensive mission. It was like $1.2 billion mission. By the time it gets out there, it's got all kinds of magnetometers and all kinds of cameras and all that stuff. And it's going to investigate Psyche, which they believe is a metal, solid asteroid. It would be the first metal asteroid that NASA actually visited. They're around 180 miles. I don't want to say diameter. They think It's potato shaped, but, you know, 180 miles long. But the spacecraft is doing good. Took a couple of hours before they put it into its final trajectory. The final stage eventually does that from SpaceX. And that was all successful. And they eventually heard signals back from Psyche. And I think a couple hours after that, they got confirmation that all these solar panels opened up on the spacecraft. Very large solar panels. I mean, you could cover the roof of your house with the amount of solar panels that they're using on this thing. And their goal is to actually have around 2 kilowatts of power, maybe 2 or 3 kilowatts of power, when they get out to this asteroid. And that's why they need such large solar arrays. If you were to power it up as it's flying near Earth, it would be 20 kilowatts of power. You know, my generator is 4 kilowatts in my house, so it would be, you know, be like running 5 of these things. But by the time it gets all the way out there, you're heading out to roughly 3 AUs, 3 astronomical units. So, you know, the inverse square law, you cut back and, you find out it's like, instead of like 4 times the power, you would need like one, it's like 1/10. Anyway, they're dropping down from 20 down to 2. So, you know, quite a bit of a drop by the time you get out to 3 AU. If it was just going to Mars, it would be probably about 4 or 5 kilowatts. But we'll see how it does. One important test that they have on it, and I've talked about it before, is the communication system. Let CW go by. Yeah, deep space optical communication. That's on Psyche. That's. I'm going to be very interested in. They're going to turn that on a couple of years from now instead of waiting 5 or 6 years. Make sure everything's working okay. And then they'll eventually run their test as it's on its way to Psyche. And that's the one where they're going to wait for a signal from Earth. Infrared laser beam will be transmitted from, they call it Table Mountain, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They've got a large facility there. They'll transmit that 5,000 watt laser in the direction of Psyche. And when Psyche picks it up, detects it, it'll hone in on it, and then it will eventually transmit a signal. Only four watts, leaving the laser on Psyche, and that will be transmitted down. It's got to hit a small area in California, you know, the Palomar Observatory. They've got this 200-inch telescope there that they're going to point at Psyche, and they've got some kind of detector on there with cryogenics attached to it where they can see an extremely sensitive, very low-powered laser. And hopefully they do that, and if they do, and they're able to convert the information, they expect it to be anywhere between 10 and 100 times more capability, more bits per second than what RF does. So we'll look forward to seeing how that works. And I guess in a couple of years they'll start getting ready to test that. And then, like, one question I was asked during the news conference was, what about when it gets to Psyche? You know, we'll be able to actually transmit data, you know, science data from that asteroid. And they said, no, that's not the plan. This is just an experiment to see if we can send infrared laser from deep space. I mean, they from the moon, they'd like to be able to do it, you know, 1,000 times that distance all the way out to the asteroid belt. They have that option if they wanted to years from now, if they wanted to try to send actual science, you know, through that system. They actually have that capability, but that's really not in the budget or in the planning right now. It's not part of the experiment. So hopefully the Hale telescope will pick the signal up and eventually they're going to take all that information. It's going to go to Caltech system over there in California, and they're going to use their computers and supercomputers, whatever, to figure out how well this thing worked. They'll be able to download all the data into that system. Anyway, we're gonna hope for the best. As far as I heard, the spacecraft is doing well, and it's right now. It's on its way to Mars. First, it's gonna eventually go to Mars and use Mars as a gravity assist. And at that point, they'll be able to test out their cameras and some other equipment. But they'll actually send probably beautiful pictures of Mars as it flies by. And not that we need it, we have orbiting satellites flying around Mars now, you know, half a dozen of them that send back data all the time regarding that planet. Any comments so far? This is WS1. Okay, there's some International Space Station news. The Russians have another coolant leak problem. I was going back in my notes, and back in January of this year, we were talking about on this net coolant leak problems, you know, with our manned spacecraft, the Soyuz spacecraft that was attached to the International Space Station, and two Russians and Frank Rubio, American astronaut, flew up on that thing. And after they were docked to the space station a month or so, they realized, oh no, there's some kind of flakes, it looked like, coming off the spacecraft. Sure enough, there's video of it, and there was ammonia leaking out of the coolant system of the Soyuz, the manned spacecraft. And, you know, I've gone over it before, but I'll make a long story short, you know, they said, oh, it's probably a meteorite that hit it, you know, made a little tiny millimeter hole in one of the pipes that feeds that system, and that's what happened. They were going to use it, maybe the crew should go back right away, but they decided, no, it wouldn't be safe, it would get maybe too hot in there, it would be too dangerous for the crew. So they decided to keep the crew on. Instead of it 6 months, they decided to stay over a year, which is what they did. And what they did was eventually they sent this broken spacecraft back through the atmosphere. Sure enough, it made it back to Kazakhstan. But the part that was leaking was part of the service module. So the Soyuz spacecraft, you have the descent module. That's the part that makes it back to Kazakhstan. The service module doesn't, and neither does the orbital module in front. Those separate before they come through the atmosphere. So there's no way to, you know, further examine the actual problem. So they figured, okay, they're okay. Sure enough, as time went by, turns out they sent a cargo spacecraft up to the space station, which kind of looks almost exactly like a Soyuz spacecraft. After it was docked to the space station, they noticed, that looks familiar. There was more flakes of ammonia flakes coming out of the system. So what happened was they realized that it's a problem, and it's been a discussion between NASA and Roscosmos, you know, what caused this thing, and they're saying, oh no, it's probably a meteorite, you know, it happened again, couldn't be a defect in our system, and it's never been confirmed. Well, here the Nauclear module. This is a massive module. You know, it's equipped with, you know, a bathroom and more sleeping quarters. You know, have a science lab inside. Very big module. It's now attached to the space station six months ago or so. And sure enough, now they just noticed there's a ammonia leak coming out of that thing just the other day. So now they're going to have to try to figure that one out. Right now they figure there's not much of a change. There's no atmospheric change. The crews are, you know, not in danger. This thing, they're not going to disconnect and just, you know, send back to Earth. This is a permanent module for the space station. Eventually we'll try to figure out what the problem is. Maybe eventually do a spacewalk. But for the time being, what they did was... NASA actually noticed it first, you know, the ground crew noticed it was a problem. that I called up, and yeah, person in contact was Jasmine Morbell. She is, again, the astronaut from Long Island, from Nassau County. They contacted her, and they said, you know, take a look out the cupola windows. Cupola windows are the ones with the six trapezoid-looking windows, and then the one big round window on top. That one's about a meter in diameter. They take a look through the cupola. So she floats up there, and she looks back at the module. Sure enough, she does see these flakes coming off the Navier module. So with that, they told Jasmine, do us a favor, close all these trapezoid type of windows, and whatever else you can do. We don't want any of this ammonia, you know, actually touching these windows. So shortly after that, they had that way to close it from the interior. They closed all the windows. And then, in fact, Morgenstein, the other astronaut, I guess they called over to him. There are two other windows, one in the Destiny module and another one over in Tranquility where they exercise. So they closed off those windows as well. So that's the story. They decided to cancel a NASA spacewalk that was planned because of this reason. They're supposed to go out and do a spacewalk and get some science samples that are outside, some cameras and things like that. So that one spacewalk that they plan has been canceled, and I guess eventually they'll reschedule that. The last thing they want is a spacewalk with ammonia floating around. Any comments? WUS2S. Okay, give some time for EchoLink in case Frank or anybody else wanted to transmit on that. Another space telescope that was launched recently, 2 months ago in July, called the Euclid spacecraft. Euclid is a European Space Agency telescope, but NASA is involved with it as well. NASA, they got involved using the detectors on board for infrared. They have an infrared spectrometer on board. So this thing was launched by SpaceX in July, and its location for operation would be at the Lagrange Point 2. If that sounds familiar, that's where the James Webb Space Telescope is located, and that's roughly 1 million miles away from Earth, roughly 4 times the distance of the Moon. And it was going to take a month or so, just like James Webb Space Telescope, to get to that location. They use enough fuel to push it along, and then eventually slows down, and eventually between the gravity of the Sun and the gravity of the Earth and the centrifugal motion of it as it's you know, actually officially in heliocentric orbit around the Sun, those combinations of gravity wind up putting this into they call it a halo orbit out of that point. So this way it's always able to look at the sky. Mostly it looks away from the Sun, you know, like to point the camera in the direction of the Sun, that's for sure. So Euclid made it out there, but they realized that when they were taking pictures that they were not too good. The pictures were not what they expected. And they realized it was apparently light hitting the outside of the spacecraft and kind of bouncing back and forth, maybe hitting another part of that spacecraft. So it took time to figure out how they were going to stop this extra light from entering the spacecraft, especially with the infrared light. You know, you don't want any kind of anything, you know, getting near these detectors. So they said, well, let's see, if we turn the spacecraft attitude just a couple of degrees, that light from the Sun hitting that part of the spacecraft anymore, and maybe that'll work. Sure enough, that worked. They knew the pictures were very good, but the accuracy was off. You know, these things have star sensors on it. They could see see where the stars are, so they track it. The star trackers zoom in on, let's say, two or three of these stars, and the computer on board, it knows exactly what it's looking at. But it wasn't holding it steady. It would look, and then it would be slightly off. And they realized the senses were being sensitized by cosmic rays that were getting into the system, and it was giving it a false reading. You know, instead of seeing a star that it's supposed to be looking at, it was seeing these cosmic rays that were hitting it. So they managed to do something. It looks like they changed the software or did something. I haven't figured out the cure for it yet. Whatever they did, it worked out. So here's this thing all the way out at Lagrange Point 2, L2. Now in a complete good operation. It's a very sensitive telescope. It's got, you know, a large diameter mirror. I think this is the one with the 4-foot diameter mirror. And Euclid is apparently doing well, starting to send back good information. The European Space Agency has, you know, set it to success, and they'll have many years of operation with it. It's supposed to be as sensitive as the Hubble telescope out there. The difference is this thing could scan the sky like 100 times more than the Hubble Space Telescope. So it does a very wide area, and the idea is to collect as many pictures as they can of all these galaxies throughout the universe, and they plan on mapping it and then mapping it over time. You know, and they've done this type of thing before on a smaller basis with Gaia, another telescope that's out there, but this one is much more sensitive and could do a lot more than any other of these telescopes. The idea is to look at the background, dark matter, dark energy. And over time, I guess they're going to try to make an evaluation and see if they could figure out what's what. And there's even talk about if this thing works out, these people, whoever came up there with the Euclid design, will wind up with the Nobel Peace Prize. So we'll see. Any comments? WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. So there's three companies that NASA is involved with, and they gave them contracts. These are, I think I mentioned this last week or so, but they gave them contracts for nuclear contracts, fission. With one company, another one to develop some type of a rocket which is going to use nuclear power. Anyway, they're handing out these contracts. One to Intuitive Machines, another one to Westinghouse, another one to Lockheed Martin. And, you know, these are like Lockheed Martin is a $33 million contract. So hopefully in the future, these companies will help NASA with their infrastructure on the moon. You know, eventually you're going to need power on the moon. Yeah, they're going to use solar panels left and right. Maybe they'll use fuel cell systems also. One of the things that they would definitely like to use is fission power, which they know what they want. It's one design that they're very happy with. It's going to put out 10 kilowatts of energy. You put a couple of those things on the moon and you know, back that up with massive batteries in case something fails, and maybe with a fuel cell system as well in case that fails. And you'll be able to have people staying on the moon through the nights, through these 14 Earth Day nights, and that would be the ultimate base on the moon. You could, you know, actually permanently have people living on the moon with a system like that. We'll see what happens over time. Okay, nothing heard. Looking for another launch in November. There's dozens of launches that go up every month now. I think SpaceX is up to, I think, over 70 launches, and they're not done yet. Their goal is to do 100 launches for this year, but there's so many of them. But I follow certain ones, like this Nova Sea Lander. Nova Sea Lander is one of the landers that are being developed by Intuitive Machines, like I mentioned before. That company has a goal of landing a spacecraft on the moon successfully with their Nova Sea lander. And hopefully that works out. And they're going to launch on November 14th, so, you know, roughly a month from now. And I think this one will probably only take 4 or 5 days. Then I got to go into an orbit, which takes sometimes months to land. I think this one's going to pretty much go direct. But if they're successful, they'll be the first private company to land on the moon. Unless this other company from Japan makes it with they call it the Slim Lander, which is on its way. And I think that should land in about a month or so. That makes it, that'll be first, for a private company anyway, to actually land on the moon. There's a bunch of them, and this company here already has contracts with NASA for it's called IM-1, this is Intuitive Machines number one, overseas flight. There's IM-2 and IM-3 are already on the drawing board. They have their hardware built for it and everything. They've got to be successful, you know, for the first one. We'll see. We'll see what happens. WS4. Okay. Not much else. I just want to mention from last week I didn't get to it was there's a Spanish company called PLD Space, and they launched a suborbital rocket into space from Spain. So, I mean, they have ultimate goals. Their rocket was a success. It went up past the common line. If they do what they plan on doing in the future, they plan on building a much larger rocket, which will eventually be launched from French Guiana in South America. So we'll see. Once they do that, they'll be doing orbital launches instead of suborbital launches. But they needed to do this first as a proof of concept, see if it worked. And let's see another company joining the mix. There's probably dozens of them right now worldwide that are trying to, emulate SpaceX.
That time complete.
But they're hard to catch. They're way ahead of the game. SpaceX is actually making money on their launches now. Where these companies, they're pouring a lot of money into it. They keep getting funding from different places until they start being successful. Like Rocket Lab is probably making money too. They've been doing pretty good as well. They've been launching out of the North Island and New Zealand for a couple of years, I think 2017. So they're doing okay. And another one just recently, Firefly, they contracted with the Defense Department with Space Force, they call it. They contracted with them to see if they could, in a hurry, get a spacecraft into space. And that was very successful last couple of weeks. The Firefly rocket, and that one launched out of California. So, SpaceX does have competition, but they're going to have a lot more in the future. A lot of companies, big and small, creating big and small rockets that are on the drawing board. I'm looking at the time. I hit 11 o'clock, so I'm going to close this portion of the TechNet down called the SpaceNet Report. Be on tomorrow night, hopefully, during the Club InfoNet, which is and that that's us at 8:30 on these frequencies. Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Paul. Our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul, for all that you do for the SpaceNet Report, all that you do for the technical net, and all that you do for the club. We we all appreciate it, and I appreciate it especially. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had fun. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a few things. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. So as always, let me leave you with a couple of quotes. Dick, K2RIW, may rest in peace. Always would end the TechNet along the lines of advice. Be kind to each other. That's always good advice. So please try and do it for your friends, for your neighbors, even for your enemies. We all got to live together here. And if you haven't had your flu or COVID vaccination booster, please consider getting it, especially if you're older than 65 or so. Please keep that in mind. Once again, like to quote Epictetus, the Roman philosopher, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. The idea being, keep your mind open to new ideas. And as always, I wish you a safe and happy week. Be well. I hope you'll be able to join us again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS. I'll be clear in a moment after I say Slava Ukraine.
Okay, 73 Roy, have a good night. Wesley, are you still there? And 2XAN, and WS2N. I put him to sleep, Roy. I wanted to talk about the political net. That always comes on after this, about Poland and an election there. Anyway, this will be WS2N clear.
Yeah, I don't think you put him to sleep. He's probably tending after his cat or something. He's a busy man. Yeah, you could always ask him next week. Yeah, I heard. There's always something going on in East Europe these days. Usually not great news.
Yeah, well, this one was. You know, the guy I wanted to get elected, or the group I wanted to get elected, one said, I don't help the Ukraine out. That's what I'm thinking about, that Slava Ukraine thing, and it's going to be good for them.
Okay, I have to look further into it. There were other elections in other Eastern European countries. Slovakia or something, that had a pro-Russian slate get elected into their government. So we'll see what the future has in store for us all.
Yeah, this is in reverse. You know, they had the 8 years of this other group in there, and apparently that group is out, and the new group is in. And you know, you don't know what's happening, but at least that went in the right direction from what I say. Anyway, you'll see it, but you'll see it on the, well, you won't see it on the news. If you put TV on, it's all about Israel. I guess you'll find it on the computer. Have a good night, Roy. WS2N.
You too, Paul. Have a good night. Be well.
7-3 guys, good job as usual. Give me 2BX.
73, Frank. Have a good night. Thanks for being here.
set.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Temperature 48 degrees.
W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 5:01 a.m. Clear. Temperature 47 degrees.
InfoNet tonight at...
Good morning. The time is 6 a.m. Clear. Temperature 48 degrees.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 7 a.m. Mostly clear. Temperature 46 degrees.
InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
WB2CSC.
W2VL repeater.
InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2AWS.
NY2H, WB2CSH.